Oversight Committee.
Good afternoon. Welcome and glad everyone's here. This is the Joint Legislative Oversight Committee on Justice and Public Safety, Room 643 in the Legislative Office Building. Today is October 13th, 2016. I'm Representative Jamie Bowles of Moore County. We'll be chairing today. We also have Senator Shirley Randleman, and which will have some remarks here shortly. And Representative Pat Hurley had an engagement she had to go to today and sends her regrets. If we'll go around and introduce our members that are here today, starting out with our Senate from Davison.
Good morning and thank you, Stan Bingham, Davison, Montgomery County. Glad to be here. Thank you, Jamie.
It's glad to be here from the east. The farther I came inland, the more trees I found down. So I don't know what you guys did to deserve to get all the wind, but you're welcome to it. Thank you.
Mike Speciale, Craven County.
Billy Richardson, Cumberland County.
Alan McNeil, Randolph, and Moore.
Darren Jackson, Wake County.
Rena Turner, District 84 in Iredell County.
Sarah Stevens, Surrey County, and a little bit of Wilkes.
Thank you. And at this time, I'll ask Senator Randleman if she'd like to have some opening remarks. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd just like to note that, you know, today we have several of our state law enforcement agencies represented in our audience, and I think this would be a perfect time to show them how much we appreciate what they do for our state and how they do their jobs to protect our citizens. So thank you, and if everyone would please join me in showing our appreciation.
Thank you. I also like to for them to introduce themselves, because we could not do this work here in Raleigh without them. Is our great professional staff that we have here in Raleigh, and we'll start with our left.
All right. Jennifer Bedford with the Legislative Analysis Division.
Gus Willis with the Legislative Analysis Division.
Mark White with Fiscal Research Division.
John Petit, Fiscal Research.
Christine Leggett, Fiscal Research.
Nicole Dupre, Bill Drafting.
Emily Johnson, Bill Drafting.
Thank you. And also just got punched in the back of the main people that keeps this thing rolling is our House Sergeant of Arms and our Senate Sergeant of Arms.
Thank you.
We have in the House Young Bay, Jim Moran, Terry McCraw, and in the Senate we have Hal Roach, there we go, and Sam Patel. Thank you. Guys, that nobody knows what you all do to prepare the room, the materials, everything, and I just like to say thank you.
Thank you.
All right. On a personal note, I would like to say thank you to it's justice and public safety, what they're doing out there. I know some people have questioned why we're even meeting here today, but it is important that the business of the state continues. DPS is doing a fantastic job. I have businesses both in Columbus County, Robinson County, Moore and Lee County, and they all have had a direct hit. And I can assure you that I have seen the works of DPS and the great work that they're doing. You know, we always think of, well, how does this get done? Well, it gets done by a dedicated staff of volunteers. I'm still on the fire department back home, and Saturday morning I left at 9:30 and got back home after 8 of cutting trees down all day from our neighbors. But what that means is that your families have sacrificed, and they have to make do on their own. And you all are still out there, DPS and other state agencies of our state, that have left their families, and their families haven't seen you. And I just want to say thank you, and you're doing a great job, and the state of North Carolina says thank you, and it's proud to be a North Carolinian. It's even an honor to be it's humbling even to be a representative or a senator and represent of what you all do. So with that, I think we had also Representative Justin Burr walk in from Stanley County. And at this time, I would like for Ryan Combs, if he would step up and give us an update, just a very general update, and give us some websites that are available to the committee members, but also to the citizens that are listening out in today. Thank you, Ryan.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chairman Bowles. I know Director Sprayberry would prefer being here today, and as would I, but I'm going to try to give you just a quick update on some of the things going on with our emergency operations. I know Governor McCrory is most pleased with how smooth the response to the storm has been handled by all of our partners. From the time Ian began preparing for the storm up to now, we've had remarkable teamwork between the federal government, FEMA, state, city, and county governments. There's 28 local emergency operations centers currently stood up that are working directly with the state EOC. We have over 1,000 National Guardsmen deployed in the disaster areas providing support. The Highway Patrol has 150 troopers deployed and are assisting with road closures and escorting supplies being brought in. ALE, the SBI, Wildlife, and License and Theft are all providing manpower and resources throughout the state. Probation and parole officers have been deployed in Moore County to assist the Sheriff's Office. And 50 local sheriff deputies from across the state were deployed to Robeson County as part of the mutual aid agreement to assist the county sheriff's office. The current emergency management priorities are to continue focusing on stabilizing situations in impacted areas, continue flood operation response, and implement recovery operations. There have been 2,299 rescues so far, and unfortunately there have been 20 storm-related deaths. As of this morning, there's 3,395 North Carolinians in 42 shelters. FEMA and emergency management are working to find rental properties and hotels to put these displaced residents in until FEMA can bring in housing. 33 schools were closed as of today, and there's 45,942 residents still without power, but which is pretty remarkable considering it was over 800,000 just a few days ago. The current flooding situation, the Cape Fear River in Bergal is currently cresting. The Tar River is cresting today in Tarboro and will be cresting tomorrow in Greenville. The Neuse is expected to crest in Kinston at record levels late Friday. Just a brief update on the FEMA assistance. 34 counties so far have been approved for public assistance, which with public assistance, that's a 75-25 match. The federal government picks up 75% of that, and the local, we have to pick up the other 25%. And we also have 17 counties that have been approved so far by FEMA for individual assistance, which is 100% federally funded. As of this morning, $2.7 million of that has already been allocated to individuals who've requested assistance. And this is an ongoing process, and assessments are continuing with additions to be made daily. So just because they're not designated for individual assistance right now, that doesn't mean it's not going to happen. This is an important thing. If you have a constituent that needs assistance and wants to apply for that, they can go to www.disasterassistance.gov to apply, or they can call 1-800-621-3362, which is the FEMA phone number. And even if you're counting...
Ryan, hold up.
Sir.
Everybody. We're a little older, Ryan, and we have glasses. And
you want me to repeat?
Let's start with WW.
Okay. www.disasterassistance.gov. And the phone number, again, is 1-800-621-3362.
And Christine is reminding me, they will send it to your emails as well.
Okay. And thank you. The important thing is, like I said, only 17 counties have been designated for individual assistance. But even if you're not in those 17 counties, you can go ahead and apply with FEMA. And if your county ends up being declared for individual assistance, you'll be processed. If you'd like to donate food, water, clothing, sheets, you can simply call 211, and they'll let you know where the closest location is to drop those goods off. If you'd like to donate money to the victims, you can go to www.ncdisasterrelief.org. That's www.ncdisasterrelief.org. Just a couple more things. We've got 16 Salvation Army canteens currently open. Wilmington, Fayetteville, Goldsboro, Greenville, New Bern, Washington, Elizabeth City, Rocky Mount, and Kinston. And the Baptist Men Kitchens, they've already served over 7,000 meals, and they're in Lumberton, Fayetteville, Kinston, Rocky Mount, Greenville, and Whiteville. And I just want to reiterate, like what Governor McCrory has been saying since day one, that he's grateful to all the first responders and volunteers who have worked tirelessly to help those in need. So that's the end of my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you. And it's not a question and answer. I just appreciate you giving us an update. And you all can contact Ryan directly if you have any other concerns or questions. Thank you. At this time, we'll move into our agenda. The training requirements. Yes. And we'll, okay, let me back up. Item number two, approval of the minutes. Senator Bingham, second. Senator Norm Sanderson. At this time, we'll ask Steve Combs, Director of the Criminal Justice Education and Training Standards Commission. Yep. And I think you also have your chairman with you.
Yes, sir, I do. Police Chief Bill Hollins at Waynesville Police Department.
Well, I'd like for him to stand up, and that's who we're going to throw the darts at. No, but thank you for being here, and thank you for chairing. The committee, do you have any opening remarks that you would like to?
Those are, I think, I'll let Director Combs, he's involved there to open the presentation.
He gets the big bucks, doesn't he?
Yes, sir.
All right. But it couldn't happen without a good board of directors. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Thank you for this opportunity to be able to address you this afternoon. My name is Stephen Combs. I am the director of the North Carolina Criminal Justice Standards Division. We serve as staff for the North Carolina Criminal Justice Education and Training Standards Commission. Before I get started, you should have two handouts with you. One will be it's basically a set of attachments to the presentation that I'm going to go over this afternoon. And then the second is a 2015 annual report. I will not refer to that document while I go through my presentation. I just thought that might be some information. It kind of gets into the weeds of what the division does and the commission does yearly. So I provided that for you for your information. I'm going to start out just giving you a brief history on the commission. In 1971, the General Assembly created the Criminal Justice Training and Standards Council Act. The General Assembly then established the North Carolina Criminal Justice Education and Training Standards Commission. This is an independent body with powers and duties that are outlined in General Statute 17C. In 1973, minimum entrance standards as well as mandatory basic training requirements became effective for all criminal justice officers in the state of North Carolina. I'd like to tell you a little bit about our commission. And again, as I said in handout number one, on page three, I've given you, provided you a list of all of our commission members. It stands at 34 members now. And it also lets you know who appointed them to our commission.
Mr. Combs.
Yes, sir.
Could we at this point recognize he's not here right now, but we have a founding member?
Yes, sir.
If you would like to comment on that, please.
Yes, Representative Faircloth, I've had the opportunity to meet. He was the first director of the Criminal Justice Standards Division. So, unfortunately...
He's in town. I think he's with Mr. Franklin Green.
Gotcha.
He should be here later, but I do think his credit.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Yes, sir. Our 34 members meet quarterly here in Raleigh to conduct our business. We operate under a three-year system plan, and the commission consists of an executive committee and three standing committees. Of course, the executive committee consists of the chair and vice chair of the commission, and then the chair of each standing committee. Our three standing committees consist of our education and training committee. This hears and reports on issues relating to course curriculum and training programs. The Planning and Standards Committee is responsible for long-range planning and conducts rulemaking hearings. And our Probable Cause Committee conducts probable cause hearings for officers accused of commission rule violations. And to give you an example of the work that they've done, in 2015, our Probable Cause Committee heard 131 cases in reference to officer misconduct or policy or violations of standards. A little about the Criminal Justice Standards Division. As I said, we serve as staff to the commission, and we're broken up into two sections, our Certifications and Field Services section and our Training and Research section, in which I have a deputy director that's over each of these. Our division has 24 full-time members, employees, and we have three what I would call permanent part-time positions, and they're testing administrators across the state and work approximately 16 to 20 hours a week. On the Certification and Field Services side, we have our Law Enforcement Officer Certification Program, our Department of Adult Correction and Juvenile Justice Officer Certification Program, Field Auditing Program, Company and Campus Police Program, and our Investigations Unit. On the training and research side, we have our basic law enforcement training administration program, our school director certification program, instructor certification program, our SMI or radar certification program, professional certificate certification program, our carrying concealed handguns and retired law enforcement officer firearms program, and school accreditations program. So now I want to move on, and I'd briefly like to give you what the minimum standards are of becoming a law enforcement officer in North Carolina. This has been in the news quite a bit lately. I know that the United States Department of Justice just recently released a report concerning minimum standards for becoming a law enforcement officer. So I wanted to let you know exactly what those standards are in North Carolina. Of course, you must be a United States citizen, be a minimum of 20 years of age. You must pass a physical exam, psychological screening, and a drug test. You must have an interview by the hiring agency and be a high school graduate or equivalent. The commission rules require that officers shall not have or have not committed or been convicted of a felony or a crime for which the punishment could have been imprisonment for more than 2 years. A crime or unlawful act defined as a Class B misdemeanor within a five-year period prior to the date of application for employment. Four or more crimes or unlawful acts as defined as Class B misdemeanors, regardless of the date of conviction. Or four or more crimes or unlawful acts defined as Class A misdemeanors, except that the applicant may be employed if the last conviction occurred more than 2 years prior to the date of their employment. So now I'm going to move on into our basic law enforcement training program. This is the program that if you're going to become a law enforcement officer in North Carolina, you're going to have to go through our basic law enforcement training. It's commonly referred to, you probably have heard, BLET. We have 64 delivery sites across the state. And as you'll see, the majority of these are community colleges that are delivering our BLET program. We do have 10 agencies that also deliver BLET, and they're typically your larger agencies, such as the State Bureau of Investigation or the State Highway Patrol, municipalities such as the Raleigh Police Department, Greensboro Police Department, or Fayetteville Police Department. Next, I would like to tell you a little bit about this program, the Basic Law Enforcement Training Program. It's designed to be an entry-level training program. It provides skills to perform essential tasks, both cognitive and physical skills. Ethical issues are presented in each topic. It's a baseline for career development. And it's reviewed by subject matter experts and legal staff quarterly, which I'll get into a little bit more a little further along in my presentation. Again, basic law enforcement training provides entry-level skills and knowledge. Our program in North Carolina consists of a minimum of 616 instruction hours. Now, any delivery site, whether it be a community college or a department or agency, can expand on those hours. The minimum is 616, and many departments and community colleges do expand on this training. To give you an idea of where we stand as far as a state compared to other states across the country, I can tell you that Hawaii has the most training hours at 1,040, and Louisiana has the less, at the least amount at 360. Out of the 46 states that report the hours of training, the average hours of a BLET program in our country is right at 621 hours. North Carolina falls at around number 18 as far as the length of our academy. The BLET program is broken down into 6 units. Again, in the handout that I provided you in handout 1 on page 8, I've broken these units down into individual topics that are taught and the number of hours for each for you to look at. The 6 units consist of legal, patrol duties, law enforcement communication, investigations, practical applications, and there is also a sheriff-specific block. Altogether, there are 36 topics of instructions, and it typically takes about 16 weeks once a cadet or student enters the BLET program until completion. I told you in my presentation, I spoke about how this BLET program is revised and reviewed quarterly, and that's done by our BLET Revision Committee. Again, in handout 1 on page 10, I've provided you the names of everyone that's on this committee and their background. It consists of 11 members. They're comprised of police and sheriff personnel, community college training directors, legal staff, and criminal justice instructors. Again, it meets quarterly, and it's advisory to our our Education and Training Subcommittee to the Commission. Just recently, this BLET Revision Committee met last Friday, and some of the work they did, this is a good example, is based on some of the things that we're seeing across the country and within the state of North Carolina, they decided to open up the mental illness block of this block of instruction. And right now it stands to be at 8 hours. My chairman to my commission had spoke with numerous chiefs across the state and also sheriffs, and they really wanted us to take a strong look at this block of instruction. Director Strickland of the Justice Academy has some great ideas of where he's going to move forward with this, so we're certainly going to see this program expand, or this topic expand within BLET. This also falls right in line with the Presidential Task Force on 21st Century Policing. In Recommendation 5.7, it advised that posts should ensure that basic officer training includes lessons to improve social interaction as well as tactical skills. And that's certainly what the Commission wants to see happen in this block of instruction. So we're looking forward to what that may bring, what that will bring to us in the future. Next, I'd like to talk to you about some BLET, basic law enforcement training trends that we're seeing. On this graph, it's very concerning that in 2013, you'll see that we had 2,713 students that went through our BLET program that year. In 2014, that number dropped to 2,457. In 2015, it continued to go down to 2,220. And of course, you'll see in 2016, we're at 1,067 students. That is a dramatic drop in students entering into BLET. I will tell you that that number for 2016, it should increase. We believe it'll increase by approximately 200 students because there are students right now going through a BLET, going through their BLET programs that aren't accounted for until we get their post-delivery reports. But we see that only probably increasing by about 200 students. So as you see, that's still a significant drop that we're looking at. I will tell you that we have a recruitment study in progress at this time. We are working with Appalachian State University, and we're hoping that this will tell us and give us some good information on what we can possibly do moving forward to get this number going in the opposite direction and moving back up. The next frame or slide you see there kind of goes hand in hand with that first one. And this is the number of canceled courses that we've had over the last few years. We've had an increase in canceled courses of a little over 6% in 2013. And let me stop there and tell you what this means. To run a BLET academy, you must have at a minimum 10 students. So that means that these academies, these delivery sites, whether a community college or an agency, could not find 10 people to put through their academy, therefore they had to cancel their academy, their training program. So in 2014, we saw a 13% increase. And to put numbers with that for you is that in 2014, there were 132 academies and 18 of them had to cancel. In 2015, we saw a little reduction. Out of 127 academies, 12 had to cancel. And then, of course, you see in 2016, a 32% increase in cancellations. That is, out of 58 academies, 19 have had to cancel because they didn't have enough people. Now, our commission and we met in our commission met in November and addressed this issue. And that what they have decided to do and voted on and passed is that we're going to make the minimum number of students, bring that down to 8. That might not seem like a big reduction, but the concern both from chiefs and school directors running these academies is that we need to have at least 8 students just to do the practical exercises that are involved in running a BLET class. So 8's going to be pretty much the minimum. So that's basic law enforcement training, and that is for the entry-level officer in North Carolina. And next, what I'd like to talk to you is concerning our program. It's called our Mandatory In-Service Training Program. Now, this is for officers that are out there working. It's mandatory. You must complete your mandatory in-service training every year. If you fail to complete this training, you are suspended as an officer and cannot perform law enforcement duties until you complete this training. Right now, it is a minimum of 24 hours for all sworn employees. We decide, and the content of this training is based on a survey from field personnel. It typically contains firearms training and qualification, legal updates, juvenile minority sensitivity training, and that's a mandate. We must have that in our in-service training every year, plus other additional topics annually. This also has a joint in-service training committee, and if you'll, again, on handout one on page 13, I've listed all the members that are on this joint in-service training committee. They also met last week and started working on the in-service training for 2018. I'm sure probably Director Strickland will talk about the need for having to meet so soon to work on training 18 months ahead, and he'll get into that with you in his presentation. But this committee consists of 25 members. and it determines the specific topics to be mandated annually. And once these topics are mandated, the Justice Academy is responsible for developing the curriculum. In the next few slides, well, I just wanted to give you and let you see, give you an idea of what this means when you look at our in-service training each year for these officers across the state. You'll see in every year there'll be firearms training and qualification, and your legal update, and of course your juvenile minority sensitivity training. In 2016, that training is the color of justice, and it talks about the defining of disproportionate minority contacts and how culture may influence the juvenile justice system. Then you also have human trafficking awareness, North Carolina firearms law, citizens and guns, 2 credits, and then the department's topics of choice. So typically what will happen is you'll have the, here in 2016, we have 16 hours, so you'll have an additional 8 hours of topics of choice. And we leave it like that so that the chief or the sheriff will be able to develop training that's more specific to their community and to their department, because every community and department's a little bit different. In 2017, again, you'll see the firearms training and qualification, the legal update. The juvenile minority sensitivity training consists of positively impacting today's youth, and they talk about the factors that impact youth and a roadmap for connecting with youth in positive ways. Domestic violence, again, and improving decision-making skills. And this topic is going to look at the decision-making process by officers and the methods of improving critical decision-making skills for officers. And then again, your topics of choice. In 2018, the topics have just been developed. So the Justice Academy will start working on the curriculum now. Again, firearms and legal update. The juvenile minority sensitivity training is going to be strategies to improve law enforcement interactions with minority youth. And then other mandatory topics will be equality in policing and communication skills with individuals in crisis and de-escalation techniques. And then also, again, you'll see the topics of choice. Next, what I'd like to talk to you about is some proactive steps that the commission is taking in developing our training and the direction that we, the division and law enforcement, moves across our state. And first is a recruitment and retention study. I hit on that earlier with Appalachian State University, in which we are in a study with law enforcement recruitment. And East Carolina University is working with us and also a recruitment study and retention study with the Department of Adult Corrections and Juvenile Justice. We're very fortunate to have these two universities so willing to work with our commission and division, so they certainly are doing this at no cost to us, and we're very appreciative. The Criminal Justice Standards Division is also conducting its own survey with law enforcement agencies across the state concerning law enforcement retention. Again, working along with the President's 21st Century, President's Report on 21st Century Policing, Action Item 5.3 talked about addressing partnerships between law enforcement agencies and academic institutions for research and development. And this is something that we certainly believe in and will continue to partner with our universities across the state. Some things that the division is doing. Myself and my two deputy directors attended fair and impartial police training. We were invited by the Morrisville Police Department to come take it and observe that training, and it was very enlightening. I've been a part of the 4th Annual Man Up Empowerment Summit. This took place in Charlotte, North Carolina, and was sponsored by Central Piedmont Community College. We attended the Legislative Black Caucus, Black Best Practices in Law Enforcement Training, and I was also part of a PBS special, Law and Order, Building Bridges and Mending Communities. Recently went to, and as an observer, the North Carolina Central University Town Hall meeting that they had, and this was broadcast across the state, where they had different schools with attendees there that could participate in this town hall meeting. I also have met with the leadership at the North Carolina Central University School of Criminal Justice in reference to minorities and law enforcement. This is a concern for every chief and sheriff across the state, making sure that we have diverse police departments that represent their communities. And Dr. McMurray and Dr. Herring were wonderful to work with and talk with, and actually invited me back, and I spoke with one of their criminal justice classes. And it was very enlightening, and I learned a lot from that experience. And last, one thing that our commission has recently started working on is a law enforcement development program. We have a committee together, and again, on handout one, page 16, it's a fairly large committee. We're taking on a pretty big task here. Page 16 will list everyone that's involved in that. It goes from chiefs and sheriffs to leaders in both the university and community college system across the state. And what we're looking at is a program that will target or find young men and women in high school that are interested in law enforcement, and we want to do that through the public safety academies that are already out there for fire and EMS. We would like to have a footprint for law enforcement in that. And as they transition, because one problem that we have in law enforcement is that you have to be 20 years of age before you become a law enforcement officer. So we would like to have some kind of have a bridge there that keeps these young men and women interested in law enforcement. Then, as they go into community college, getting their associate's degree, and even in the university system, and keep them interested in law enforcement to help us with our applicant pool that we're struggling with so bad now. For instance, right now, the university system, East Carolina University, if you're a criminal justice major at East Carolina University, you have to do an internship. And they've just recently, instead of doing an intern, you can go through BLET instead. And that is a wonderful practice. So these young men and women, when they graduate with their degree, will be able to walk right across the street to Greenville Police Department or anywhere in the state and go to work as a law enforcement officer. This is in the infant stages. There's a lot that we have to look at here. We've had two meetings so far. Our next meeting, we're reaching out to all the chiefs and police chiefs and sheriffs across the state to get their input and where they'd like to see this program go. Again, I want to thank you very much for this opportunity to speak to you today. And if you have any questions, I'd certainly like to be able to answer them for you.
Representative Faircloth. And we did mention your name earlier as a founding member, and I noticed the policies have changed, but you haven't.
I apologize for being late, Mr. Chairman.
You were a good cause.
I was trying to handle a problem. I think we got it taken care of, so I'm glad to be here now.
Yes, sir.
And this is an excellent topic.
Yes, sir.
And years ago, we got a wonderful start. We got all the way up to 35 hours of training, I think, when we first started. So it's been a long haul for these folks, and you're doing a great job. I just wanted to ask, with respect to getting or the period of time between graduating from high school and reaching 20 years of age, where we're probably losing some potential officers in there. At one time, there were a lot of cadet programs in municipal departments. Is there much of that going on anymore?
I know exactly what you're talking about, sir, and no, they are not. And every meeting we have, this is brought up and looking at bringing back these cadet programs. I believe one was the last one that was being held was at the Justice Academy, and Director Mark Strickland will probably be able to expand on that a little bit more. But they haven't been forgotten. And as I said, each meeting we have, that comes back up. Is this something we should look into? It's very similar, too, to what these public safety academies are doing. I was able to see this firsthand at Gardner High School. They had in the evening, you would come and see the different departments for your children. And some of the tables, there just weren't a lot of people there. Well, they had the public safety academy at, and it was a fire safety academy. You couldn't get through the hallway. So many young men and women were there. They had someone in a fire department outfit, fire suit, and we want to get in on that action. I mean, you could tell that these young men and women were really interested in that and wanted to be. We're looking at that as a career, and what a great opportunity to reach out to them.
I think as you perhaps take a look at that, we need to involve the municipalities in this, because I suspect a part of the cadet program's dying out was funding, the tight dollars that the municipalities had to work with. But this is an investment for them, a cadet program is, and they're going to get better people that they already know before they're ever out there doing the job, and they're going to save money in the long run. So anything that we can do, Mr. Chairman, along that line, I think we should encourage this.
Yes, sir, and actually that brings up a good point in that Mr. Ed Munn, he is the city manager for Gastonia, is also on this committee, and you're right, absolutely.
And Mr. Combe, do we still, I know as far as the fire department, we still have the explorers, like the Boy Scout explorers, and I didn't know if that was part of, I think, what you're talking about maybe, or the...
Mr. Chairman, that was, if I may, the explorers, many departments have explorer units attached to them, but the cadet program was a separate official police slot. It was an employee, a cadet who was doing some things. They had responsibilities. They worked with officers. They helped when they had open houses and what have you. Very good program, but it's different from the explorers.
Thank you.
I will say, Mr. Chairman, that many departments do still have the Explorer program and utilize that.
Thank you. I have a to your left, Mr. Combs, Senator Bingham was first, and then Senator Bryant after Senator Bingham.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Combs, I had some questions along similar lines of Mr. Faircloth, and John, just wanted to tell you, your boss really bragged on you before you arrived. So anyway, he was telling you the truth. But anyway, on the minimum age of 20, I had concerns also. But could someone say 18 or 19? Because you're talking about a lot of hours. Could they begin taking coursework prior to 20 or not?
You can start the BLET program at the age of 19.
Okay. May I ask a follow-up, Mr. Chairman? Is any other states, I mean, it seems to me that 18, is, as John had mentioned, would be ideal for someone graduating from high school to begin taking this coursework. Is any other states, do some of the other states allow youth to start at an earlier age? Even, I know you said 19, but is that consistent across the U.S., or is this just for North Carolina?
I believe it is consistent across the United States. I think there's a concern with the maturity level of a young man or young woman becoming a police officer at such an early age. And I know in the past, is my understanding, there's been a lot of reluctance to lower that age.
Okay, what about taking the coursework? I mean, it seems like if that was going to grow them up, taking some of this coursework here would certainly do that.
It's certainly something we could look at. There is an administrative rule in place at this time that once you complete basic law enforcement training, you have 1 year in which you have to be hired with a law enforcement agency. And that's just because we don't want too much time to go by after you've received this baseline of training to be in the field and applying it. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bryant.
Thank you, sir. I had a couple of questions. One is, I wanted to strongly encourage the cadet program and designing it similar to an internship format, where it's a good job for a person coming out of high school and they get to learn a lot of the basic operations. I'm sure there's some kind of worthwhile, you know, some actual job work they can do.
They're absolutely
in the department that would be valuable to the department, and maybe it could be with the condition that they within 1 year enroll in the BET.
Absolutely correct. And there's many things from working evidence records that they can be doing in that department. So you absolutely, yes, ma'am.
And then I had a follow-up. I'll change in the subject a little bit. I couldn't tell from the topics. I could imagine it might be included, but I was wondering, where are in the BLET, do you cover stuff like use of deadly force, racial diversity and navigating cultural differences, or racial profiling, or even emotional literacy in terms of fear and anger and yourself and diffusing it in others and that kind of stuff. Where does that happen?
Yes, ma'am. A lot of that occurs in the SCADR and the defensive tactics training, the law enforcement training.
I have a breakdown, I believe.
I'm on page 8 and looking at the list, but is it?
Yes, okay. Ma'am. It also, in the mental health section, talks about that already now, but it's only 8 hours, so we wanted to increase that. The number of training, number of hours of training. Patrol techniques will also hit on that some. So it's scattered throughout the training, but again, that is one reason why we wanted to open up the block of mental illness. We feel a lot of this would fit perfectly within that and have it all in one section. But it does need to be addressed a little bit more, and that's what we've come to realize.
I just wanted to make a comment. I agree. In my experience, if we could be the more explicit we could be about it,
yes, ma'am.
I think the better people will, first of all, understand the significance, know what we're talking about, and probably feel more empowered in embracing it, given the current reality we have and the complex challenges that our law enforcement agents have, you know, with their own backgrounds as well as the community. I definitely think we need probably an explicit block on it or section and give it significant time so that we aren't waiting until they get a refresher, they get hired,
yes, ma'am,
and have to get one of these in-services to address the issue. And while I appreciate what's happening with the young people on the minority and juvenile front, you know, the required training for sensitivity on the juvenile front, I think it clearly applies across the board, and the sooner we start and position people, the better off our communities will be. So I wonder. Right.
Thank you.
That's exactly what the chiefs and sheriffs have been telling us across the state.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative McNeil.
Thank you. Right over here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. I've been sitting over here kind of hiding. But anyway, as a certified basic law enforcement instructor trainer and detention officer trainer, I know from my experience that 3 or 4 years ago, I was teaching classes when I had 30 students, and now they're lucky to make a class of 10 students. And I don't want to get ahead of your study, because I know you said earlier that y'all are doing a study to try and find out why people just don't want to get into law enforcement anymore. But I'm sure you have probably heard some things. I just wonder if you have any thoughts on, is it an interest gap, or are young kids just not interested in it now? Is it a pay situation? Is it that, you know, family members just don't want them to get into a dangerous profession? Is it all of the above? Can you give us any kind of insights as to what, because I've seen it firsthand.
Well, I do have an answer for that, Representative McNeil. When I told you earlier, I went and spoke with a class, criminal justice class at North Carolina Central University. And as we talked about different issues near the end of the class, it was a class of about 40 students. I asked how many of you were interested in going into local or state law enforcement. And about 43 of them raised their hands. And that was very concerning. And I asked why. And it was surprising when I heard the answer. And now, granted, this was approximately a year ago. It wasn't so much about some of the things that they'd seen across the country. It was more about an overall lack of respect for law enforcement. It was a concern, and I hear this quite often, a concern that they have $60,000, $70,000, or even $80,000 worth of school debt, and it's not very appealing to them to come work for a police department that starts off at $31,000 or $32,000 a year. They talked about shift work and other things. And it was interesting, after I had this conversation, I called my chairman of my commission, and Chief Hollingshead teaches at Western Carolina University, a criminal justice class there. And he asked the class the same questions and got the exact same response. It wasn't so much some of the things that we're seeing, and there are issues there, but it was an overall lack of respect for law enforcement that they had and perceived. And it was certainly this issue, a pay issue, especially at the university level, even though I've even heard it from those receiving their associate's degree, the debt that they've incurred, and is it appealing to go work in law enforcement, because sometimes there's this feeling of low pay.
Follow up. One more question, taking off on that. I know that at over the last couple of years, people were military officers that are coming back from deployment, a lot of them are interested, or at least I felt like a lot of them were interested in getting into law enforcement. But I don't. It doesn't seem like that has played out like I thought it would be. Do you have any ideas on where we're at with that? Are you seeing? And I know that wave of people coming back from deployment has probably peaked. But do you see a lot of those coming back going into law enforcement, or are they going somewhere else? Because I'm not seeing them show up in class in numbers that I thought they would.
Yes, sir, and I agree. I would have thought the same, Representative McNeil. And we actually, as you well may be aware, that we have a program for military MPs to transfer a lot of the experience and training they have to transfer over. It certainly has not been as robust a program as we would have hoped. We probably only average one or two applicants a month that are interested in doing that, and then a lot of times they don't even follow through with it. I will tell you that our commission just recently passed, even though we have that program there, they recently passed a proposal to allow any military member. For instance, in Fayetteville, their MPs are put through the basic law enforcement training program just because they like the program so much. So we've developed a program that if within 5 years of you rotating out of the military, if you've gone through BLET, through the Justice Academy, they can do their in-service. So those 5 years, they'll be eligible to come out of the military and walk right into a police department if they so wish. So we're hoping once this program, it goes through the rulemaking committee process and we get word of it out, that hopefully that'll help us some with keeping these military people here in North Carolina.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Combs.
Could I just a final statement?
I've got five more presenters.
I understand. Just a final statement.
One direct question.
I look forward to the results of your study, because this is a serious problem, and we're going to get to the point where we don't have the good qualified candidates that we need to backfill these positions in law enforcement, and we're going to be forced, I don't want to see it, to lower the standards just to fill those positions. And this is an important issue, and I applaud y'all for the direction y'all headed in.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Combs. And just to remind the committee, this is an oversight. They're just giving us an oversight. We do know we have work to do after the presentations. We come back to Raleigh in January, and so be thinking about what we can do to help them. But we're also going to need you to communicate with us about how we can help you.
Yes, sir.
So I thank you for your time. Next, we have Dr. Lisa Chapman, Vice President, Chief Academic Officer with the North Carolina Community College System. Would you come on down, please? And just to remind the committee that we have, after Dr. Chapman, 1, 2, 3, 4 more presenters. So they're giving us a great overview, and we know that we'll be talking to them again. That's right, Alan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I appreciate the time, and I will speak quickly.
And if you'll state your name and position for the record, please.
Sure. I'm Lisa Chapman. I'm the Senior VP for Programs and Student Services and the Chief Academic Officer at the North Carolina Community College System. I also want to, though, share my appreciation not only to our law enforcement personnel, but to their families as well. My grandfather was a chief of police in a small town in Southwest Virginia, and then I have a brother-in-law who retired from the Fayetteville Police Force. His son has followed in his footsteps, and I know how much they give and how much their families give, so I'm greatly appreciative of this. Yes, Bobby. I might have made a mistake there. Most of what you will see that I'm sharing supports what you saw from Director Combs and the information that he shared. We do have 55 of our 58 colleges that are approved by DOJ to offer BLET programs. But as he mentioned repeatedly, there's that minimum of 10 enrollment required for the program to offer. And we've had at least one of our colleges for the last several years not meet that enrollment. so has not been able to offer the program. But you see that we have the opportunity for students available across the state. We do follow in our BLET programming the DOJ education training and standards requirements. So the faculty do have to be certified. They for their blocks and general instruction, the school director has to meet all of the requirements that DOJ specifies, and I appreciate the fact that there's great opportunity offered throughout the year for us to be able to ensure that our faculty and our directors have the education and training that they need to make sure that they're preparing our students. In addition, we use the curriculum that is provided by the Justice Academy, and he described that curriculum, so I don't need to repeat that for you. We maintain a minimum for our programs of 620 hours, so you will find that across the state in the community college programs. And then certainly we follow the commission's admission requirements as well for students coming into the program, those that the director described. If you look at our enrollment, you will see something very similar to what he shared with you. I will tell you there's a little bit of a difference in the fact that we're talking more about academic years and he was talking about calendar years. But as we looked back to the 2009-2010 year, what we really saw was that in 11-12, 12-13, just as he indicated, we had a little bit of a dip enrollment then. We had an increase, fairly substantial increase in the 13-14 year with the over 2,500 enrollment in our programs. And then we saw a significant decline in 14-15, a little bit of an uptick there then in 15-16. So again, the numbers are very similar to what the director shared in his presentation. When we gave some consideration to that and looked to see if there were any trends throughout our programs, what we did see is that there was fairly consistent enrollment in our urban areas. Some limited fluctuation maybe at one program or another, but nothing that we saw that made any drastic changes throughout those programs in the urban areas. In our rural areas, we did see much more fluctuation than we saw in the larger cities. So it was less consistent. There was more fluctuation in our western programs and our western schools than we saw in the east, and that fluctuation varied. We might see a spike in one school, a drop in another school, some schools that had some steady up and down. So we did not see any specific pattern that we could attribute to a certain area or a certain demographic. We did look at our BLET enrollment as a percentage of the total annual unduplicated enrollment of all of our programming across the colleges. And what you'll see, taking those same numbers that you saw in the earlier slide, is that in 11-12, we did, and 12-13, we had a bit of a drop in terms of its percentage of total enrollment. And then it has been fairly steady since then. You know that we've had somewhat of a decline in enrollment over the past few years as well. So it mirrors a little bit of what we have seen with our overall student enrollment. We also looked a little bit at the demographics as well, because you know that that's something that we spend some time considering. And if in particular in our 2015 academic year population for our BLET students, you see that 69% were Caucasian, 17% were African American, and 6% Hispanic, and 8% other. That represents a little bit of an increase in terms of our African American population in our BLET programs from the year before. So we're continuing to certainly support the diversity in our programming as well, and appreciate the need for that. If you look at the gender, no surprise here, 81% of our students in that 2015 year were male and 19% were female. And then if you look at the age, and again, you all had some conversation about the must be the 20 years of age for admission, a little bit of flexibility with that 19 that the director mentioned. But we see that the bulk of our students that are enrolled in our programs are in that 22 to 30 age group. We do have some, as was mentioned, some of our veterans come back and are interested in the programming. We certainly would like to encourage more and more of them to engage as well. And then just to give you a final overview of what happens with our programs after our students have finished, because it is, as the director went through, a very rigorous program, lots of expectations. I spent a number of years at a college working with our BLET programs, and I'm not so sure I would have been the best candidate to go through some of the POPAT and some of the other opportunities that are available to the students. But you will see that our passing rate, and that's the first-time test taker, so we look at that in our performance measures, has maintained around 82 to 83%.
I'm sure you could pass the firearms, couldn't you?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Any question? Senator Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the, I'm just curious, on the passing rate, you had 80. I know that's very consistent, but say, for example, they don't pass one portion of this. Do they have an opportunity to retake this, or how does that work?
So the, and I may, if I may, Mr. Chair, defer to Director Combs about the what's required for the certification, the statewide exam, and what you can do. There's a difference with in terms of our instruction and the blocks of instruction, but if he wouldn't mind answering that question.
Mr. Combs, right. If you just come to the front, I think what he's asking, there's six parts. Do you take six different parts, or if you pass, if you'll mash the green button, and if you'll state your name for the record, please.
I'm Stephen Combs, Director of the Criminal Justice Standards Division, and in the state comprehensive exam, you can fail two topic areas and still pass. If you fail more than two, you have to retake the state exam.
Okay, you said two. How many parts are this? I mean, it seems like a lot of training. So I'm just curious as to how many parts. You're saying two parts.
There are, I believe, six units, and then those are broken down into topics, and a total of 36 different topics.
Okay, so if you fail two topics, then you got to retake the entire, go back through the whole process?
No, sir, correct? You would retake those topic areas.
Oh, you retake those topic areas, and then you could, if you pass that, you'd be good to go.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Thank you
very much. Thank you. Any other questions? All right, Doctor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for what you're doing in the community college system, and it's the backbone of our community. Next, we have Mark Strickland, Director of the Justice Academy, Department of Justice.
Come on up. You want this one or that one? There you go. Thank you very much, Chairman Bowles, committee members. It's an honor to be here today with you to talk about the North Carolina Justice Academy. We're one academy with two campuses. One's in Salemburg, North Carolina, which is about 60 miles southeast of here. And one is in Edneyville, North Carolina, and it's located about 30 miles southeast of Asheville. The Justice Academy was established by the General Assembly with the General Statute of 17D. It was established in 1973, but we actually started conducting training in 1974. So 2 years ago, in 2014, we celebrated our 40th year of conducting training throughout the state of North Carolina. Edenville was brought on campus or on site in 1999, so we're very excited to have a presence in the western part of the state. As I mentioned, Salemburg campus, which is located about 60 miles southeast of here, we have 19 classrooms, we have 3 firing ranges, we have a driving track, we have 2 computer labs, which are part of the campus classrooms there. We have a crime scene area along with a lab to go with that. We also have a cafeteria, an auditorium, and a gymnasium. In Edenville, and Salemburg is located with 100 acres. Edenville has about 23 acres. We have 5 classrooms. We also have a practical skills room. We have a practical skills area. Also have a computer lab. It has an indoor firing range. And as you're aware, the Western Crime Lab is being built on the campus. And hopefully, right now the projections are for July 17 for that to be open. I was asked earlier to give an update on the Salemburg campus with the storm information that took place. When you're in a situation, you don't have electricity and you don't have water, it's kind of a tough situation, but you don't know what's going on around the entire state. You can only see what you see in front of you, and you're kind of busy doing what you have to do. And then all of a sudden, I started seeing what was going on in Robeson County and in Tarboro and Edgecombe County and other counties. They're hit much worse than we've been hit. We had some flooding on our campus. Our classroom building, which holds 8 classrooms, was flooded. Over this past week, we have taken the carpet out. We've removed the chairs. We've moved all the electronics. Hopefully, within the next week, we'll have new carpet reinstalled. We probably had about 30 trees that have fallen. We have one of our buildings, we found out today, has some shingles that have been severely blown off. But we are in really good shape. We have taken that classroom building offline right now. The cement has to dry because it's absorbed so much water. Once that happens, we should be back and running full capacity by October 31st and allowing everybody else to come in. I'd also want to thank several members of our partners came out to help. Several members from the staff development training came out and really helped us clean up this information. My staff did a really good job. I'm very proud of each and every one of them. So before I continue, if there are any questions about that? Okay. Thank you very much. Continuing on, at the Academy we have 5 training centers. One's the Commission In-Service Center, Investigative Center, Law Enforcement Leadership Center, Legal Center, and Tactical Traffic Center. The Commission Center deals a lot with Director Combs' area and deals with the commission-mandated courses, whether it's the basic law enforcement training course or the in-service materials that we write. But we also serve as well the Sheriff's Commission, which includes the telecommunicator certification course as well as the detention officer certification course. Also with instructor training and many of our specialized instructor courses. So those folks are busy kind of doing the course development for the commission. Our investigative center is real busy doing interview and interrogation. We do background investigations. We help these investigators do a really good job to help the citizens and help solve crimes. Our law enforcement leadership center, just what it says, is for leadership. We do first line supervision. We have new sergeant's course. We have a new chief's course. We also have the flagship course we call Management Development Program. And this is an 11-month program that chiefs or sheriffs or aspiring chiefs and sheriffs to help us increase their skills to help them with their agency. Our legal center, the main course that they do each and every year is the Police Law Institute. It's a 2-week course, and it talks about the different changes in the law and help officers when you talk about probable cause, reasonable suspicion, and areas of there. And our tactical and traffic center, that's where we do the specialized training. That's our firearms. That's our subject control, which is our self-defense, our driving, our crash investigations. And that's where our use of force instructor is as well. All 5 of these centers deal with the bubbles on the left. We provide advanced law enforcement training for officers throughout the state, in-service training, have the course development, and provide educational and training materials throughout the state. couple things that I want to tell you about the Academy. As I mentioned earlier, we work very well with the two standards divisions. The Academy is their curriculum development arm for the two commissions. We have telecommunicator and detention for the sheriffs, and the other ones that I've mentioned for the criminal justice standards. We publish education and training materials for all law enforcement officers throughout the state and develop courses to address the new challenges which confront law enforcement each and every year. As part of General Statute 17D2C2, we provide technical assistance for those folks that give us a call. For all practical purposes, many of my instructors are widely considered to be subject matter experts in the field that they present. Now, while I may not be the expert, I even get calls for technical assistance for different questions that folks have in what happens on the street, but also how to go through and to become a police officer, to be a detention officer, what happens in this area. We also give guidance on identifying drugs for patrol officers and specialized skills, such as identifying hazardous materials and bombs. And we keep current on the law enforcement needs, such as knowing how to handle computer hard drives, videos, and other digital or electric materials. You have a snapshot here, and I know this is small print, but this is the kind of the courses that we've have going on in this month. And as you can imagine, we've had some courses which have been canceled this week. But this kind of gives you a snapshot of the courses that we present and deliver year-round. In 2015, we have a new registration system. We've actually gone online with our registration system. The old days were where officers would either fax or mail in the registration system. Now they can go online, sign up for classes. We've fully gone to our dorm registration, so there's that connectivity between when folks register, we can actually have them registered for the dorms. These are some of our client metrics. In the 2015-2016 year, we served 309 police departments in the state of North Carolina, 97 sheriffs, 16 government agencies in North Carolina, and 11 federal agencies. In that same time period, you see on campus and off campus, we do training on our campuses, but we also do training off our campuses as well. We'll take the training to that particular agency. Those numbers come out to 10,600 and so, over 10,500. For our outside agencies that did training on our campus are 6,895 for this time period. And what's really astounding is that during this time period, our online training events were 31,025, which is really incredible. And for both campuses, we had bed nights of 54,584. And I want to remind you that when law enforcement officers take training on our campus, there's no charge for the training or charge for staying in the dorms. And there's been significant growth as far as agencies have improved as well. One of the areas that we've really, really gotten good at is our online training. And our new registration system comes with a learning management program that goes with it. So it's a seamless effort between they register for a class and then take the online training. So it's not just registration, they can go there and take the class. Before we got into this new registration system, we were probably doing about 2,500 courses a year. And that sounds good, but when we first started this class, we all of a sudden hit 10,000. And this previous year, we've hit over 31,000. Now that equates to dollars and cents in the bottom paragraph there. When we take the average, according to the United States Department of Labor, $27.31, and average it out with the number of hours of travel time, and we kind of guesstimated of an hour to the training, an hour home, that's approximate savings of $546,000 just by doing what we've been able to accomplish with the new system. Director Combs talked about the in-service training, and he showed you the different courses which have been approved for the 2017 and also what are going to be presented to the commission for the 2018. The Joint In-Service Committee is made up of chiefs, made up of sheriffs, made up of state law enforcement, as well as community college members. And as Director Combs reported, we met last week. They talk about the different issues. We make some suggestions, but it's their decision of which courses that they feel that need to be presented to our law enforcement partners throughout the state. Once this one of these topics have been picked, which they were picked last week, we will take this document and present it to the Education and Training Subcommittee of the full commission. At that point, they'll take it to the full commission to get approval. We'll also take the sheriff's topics, which are the detention and telecommunicators, to the sheriff's commission and make these recommendations as well. And then they'll go and hopefully get approved. Then we'll work on training objectives. And then the delivery or the development period will start very closely after the training objectives have been approved by both commissions. We offer 4 instructor updates, 2 at the end of this year, 2 at the beginning of next year. And what that does, that gives the instructor, the person who's going to deliver that information out in the field, the opportunity to talk to the developer to find out, how did you come up with this? Or what was the thought behind this? This is very well attended. I know that we've got close to 300 folks which are signed up for these 4 deliveries. And enhanced training. You see a picture up here. This is our use of force simulator. This is John Evans from WECT, which is out of Wilmington. They came and wanted to go through some of our programs, take a look at it, and they did a very nice report about the things that should happen at the Justice Academy. This is one portion which we're very proud of. We have a use of force simulator in Salemburg and a use of force simulator in Edneyville. This was installed at the end of May, 1st of June. Also in this deal, and that's not the deal, might not be the right word, but in this area, we've got new instructors. We have a use of force instructor, we have a sexual assault instructor, as well as a community relations instructor. This past year, we got a crime scene investigator and a narcotics instructor. Those two positions, and then I'll come back, those two positions, one of them closed on the 10th, and the other one closed as far as on the 12th. So hopefully those applications will come to us. When we look at the use of force instructor and the community relations instructor, and we kind of look at those two and kind of package those together, we're taking a holistic approach. And Senator Bryant, you're exactly right. We're looking at the mental illness block. And kind of answer a little bit more of your question, the topics you mentioned earlier are included in the basic law enforcement training, but they are segmented. And so they're different areas, and we're going to look at that and see how can we bring those together, kind of stand them out. I agree with that wholeheartedly. We've taken a holistic approach to look at this, what I call the communication of law enforcement. So I brought many of my instructors on board, my telecommunicator instructor, my field training officer instructor, my officer safety, my use of force, my community relations, my first line supervision, and we're bringing everybody together to the table we've looked at this issue, and we're coming up with a game plan. How can we all be on the same sheet of music? And with Representative Freckle, that's kind of the conversation that we had several months ago. And we want to make sure that we're doing it the right way. Here we have a kind of an expansion needs and renovation needs for the North Carolina Justice Academy. The first one is the Dorm C renovation. That's our high-rise. That's our 3-story dorm. This past budget year, $900,000 was allocated for renovation. That goes through a portion of it, but we're still looking at $3.5 million to fully renovate and complete this program. Also at the Eastern Campus, our Dorm B needs some renovations. The Eastern Campus, the Jones Auditorium building, that has 3 classrooms and an auditorium. Looking at proposed renovations there. The administration building, $1.7 million. East and West Academies, as far as the roadway, we have potholes. Sometimes very difficult to get around. My maintenance staff does a really good job patching those as best as possible. And at the Western Academy, we requested a new dorm. Right now, we have 72 beds at the West Campus. The new dorm would fulfill with a request for 100 beds, and we have 172-bed capability at the West Campus. And here's just some pictures that we've taken at both of those campuses for you to look at. Representative Bowles?
Thank you, sir. The representative from Guilford County.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One question and then a suggestion. when if a student goes down there from a sheriff's department, goes through the BLET training, or does it at a community college for that purpose, and they go to work at the sheriff's department, and then later on they decide they want to move over to a police department, how does that acceptance of this BLET work?
Can I call on Director Combs?
Sure. If you'll just state your name again, please.
Stephen Combs, Director of Criminal Justice.
The Standards Division. They can transfer right over from one side to the other as long as there hasn't been any break in service. So usually there's no issue there whatsoever.
Thank you. And follow up. I think this committee would profit greatly by taking a trip to Salemburg and going through. I know we've been to other sites and other places, but we need to go down there. And I want them to have that shooting equipment you have lined up so that we can put Justin Burr through it and see how he does.
Representative Faircloth, we welcome you anytime.
And Representative Faircloth, the staff is setting up sites. We haven't wanted to do any site visits because of the election, because we knew that there are some members that would not be able to attend. After the elections, between now and January, please put gas in your car and we'll meet you there, because they have several other sites that are going to be set up. Thank you.
And as I said, we welcome you anytime.
Senator Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question would be, would there be an opportunity, or is there presently, or even maybe in the future, an opportunity for a citizen who's interested in some of these topics to take these courses if you had space available just to sit in, or is that a no-no?
I'm not going to sit here and tell a state senator no, but we have a hierarchy for our courses, and they're for the criminal justice professional for the state of North Carolina. And so we have traditionally not allowed the regular citizens to come in and take our courses.
Okay. Thank you. May I ask one follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
Very short follow-up.
Okay. What about in other areas of the state? Do they allow that, or is that something you would know or not know?
I would not know that.
Has that ever been discussed or talked about? I mean,
we've talked about it before, and what we have kind of held back to with or go back to is our mission statement and the general statute, and stayed with the providing training to the criminal justice professionals in the state. With that, I will tell you that we also do provide training to advocacy groups, long-term care facilities. Savin will come to our campus as well and do training, and we will work with those folks. So I'm not saying no, but there's specific things that we have to work within.
I understand. The reason I said that, like say for example, fraud and other thing with computers and all these other things, a lot of people would be maybe possibly very interested in just to listen in and maybe even a help to you down the road, and that's the reason I was kind of interested in knowing if you had the opportunity for someone as such to do that. But anyway,
thank you,
Senator. Senator Bryant?
I just wanted to pick up on that and follow up a minute to say that in response to the reduction in applications, issues about respect and appreciation of law enforcement and what's involved, probably beefing up, coming up with, and I don't know that Salemburg is the right place given our level of investment and what your priority is, whether it's the State Human Relations Division or some other group who might take on some kind of community engagement training so that citizens can get a better sense of what's involved with law enforcement, how to interact, what are the important steps citizens should take, And I know lots of local agencies have academy, citizens academies, and take those kind of initiatives and have even started beefing those up, given the level of tension with citizen police interaction. You know, what to do when you're stopped? How can I make sure my child will be treated fairly? Blah, et cetera. So I think it is important to look at, if not at Salemburg, how can we help build up that part of the community policing education program so that we can have citizens feeling more connected and engaged and understanding what's involved, which then might increase their willingness for their child to do it or that kind of thing. So it might have an additional benefit.
Thank you, Senator Bryant. All right, any other? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that was a commentary.
But I would like to respond.
Very short.
Okay. We have a community-oriented policing program as well as a community relations instructor. What our plan is to create a train-the-trainer so officers can go back in their communities and know what the resources are, know what their partnerships are to help with that specific issue that you're talking about.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for coming in, Mr. Director Strickland. Thank you. And if you have any comments, you can contact him directly. Thank you. Next, we have a director of the SBI, Robert Schumeyer, and he's going to introduce some of his agents. And Director Schumeyer, I just want to thank you all for what you're doing. We've talked before several times this week. You're a stealth plane. Nobody knows what you do, and that's a good thing. But I know you're out there. Your agents have been all over this state, and I thank you for your service.
Thank you again. My name is Bob Schumeyer, Director of the SBI. Chairman Bowles, Chairman Randleman, who stepped out, I presume, and committee members, thank you for allowing us this opportunity to come before you. And thank you for all your continued support of the SBI and ALE. Your work to make our pay competitive and to afford us our first purpose-built aircraft makes a difference. You may have heard me speak before that whatever disciplines of law enforcement we are involved in, we will endeavor to be the best in the country and make our state proud. We've achieved that already in at least one discipline. At the core of our effort to achieve excellence and to be the gold standard for law enforcement is our training. I'm pleased to introduce Special Agent in Charge Carl Wall with the SBI and ALE Special Agent in Charge Jason Locklear of our training section, who will briefly share an overview of our new agent training, our in-service training, and our supervisory and management training. Thank you for allowing us this time and opportunity to share with you this important facet of our organization.
Thank you, sir. And thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Mr. Wall, if I could get you to state your name, please, for the record.
Special Agent Carl Wall. I'm the special agent in charge of the training section for the SBI. And what we wanted to do today was give you a training unit overview for both the SBI and ALE. As you've heard already from Director Combs and Mr. Strickland, Director Strickland, all new hired SBI ALE special agents who do not yet have basic law enforcement training or BLET are sent to a local community college to complete BLET. Every law enforcement officer in the state must complete this standardized curriculum, which, as you've heard, is 616 minimum hours. If someone has completed BLET, if a newly hired agent has, that special agent trainee then attends the SBI Special Agent Academy or the ALE Advanced Academy. The SBI training section staff, I'll go over that right quickly. The SBI has one special agent in charge of training. We are supported by three assistant special agents in charge and two special agent in charge and one training coordinator. We also have one armorer assigned to the training section, and we all across the state teach various courses and classes for the SBI, as well as other local law enforcement and state offices. The SBI training section has one full-time administrative assistant and one part-time processing assistant. The SBI, as I said, training staff coordinates, instructs various classes to state and local law enforcement and other entities.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Jason Locklear, special agent charged with alcohol law enforcement. On the ALE training section staff, ALE has one special agent in charge of training, a SAC over training. The training section is supported by alcohol law enforcement special agents from across the state who teach various courses and classes for alcohol law enforcement. We're also supported by the community colleges. We pull in some of the community colleges to assist with some classes that we do. And we also use staff from the North Carolina Justice Academy to teach some of the courses that we have, such as the Police Law Institute, which is our legal training. We use the Justice Academy staff for that. The training section has no dedicated administrative support. Administrative headquarters staff step in and assist with that as necessary. ALE instructors from across the state teach various classes to state and local law enforcement and other entities as requested. Training costs, so what does it cost for SBI or ALE to conduct our training? SBI Special Agent Academy on average produces two academies a year with approximately 17 to 20 trainees per academy. The ALE Advanced Training Academy on average produces one academy each year with approximately 10 to 12 trainees per academy. And the average cost to run an SBI academy is $77,000. The average cost to run an ALE academy is $55,000. There is no training budget for that. Cost includes consumables, our instructors, the equipment that is used during the academy, uniforms, and medical care. The training budget, SBI and ALE utilizes asset forfeiture and appropriated funds to produce their academies. And there is no training budget for either SBI or ALE.
And now I just wanted to speak on the Special Agent Academy for the SBI. It is a 19-week residential training academy. It consists of 720 hours of training, which, as I said, is in addition to having BLET certified. The academy is conducted as a quasi-military style concentrating in academics, which is our main focus. Each day for the academy trainees starts at 5:30 a.m. and it ends when training is complete. Agents on average, 40 hours a week of training per week, 4 days a week of physical training. The training is at our academy is focused on the core job functions of an SBI agent in which he or she must perform.
The ALE Advanced Training Academy, is a 20-week residential training academy. The academy is conducted in a paramilitary style. Each day starts at, as Site Wall stated, it starts for us also at approximately 5:30 a.m. each morning and ends when the training is complete. Agents average about 50 hours of training each week. Agent trainees PT 4 days a week, and that begins promptly at 5:30 a.m. in the morning. And the longest training days during one of our academies may run approximately 16 to 24 hours. That is rare during the academy, but those days are built in. And this is by design to simulate real-world conditions under which the agent must perform. And the most hours logged by an ALE trainee during 1 week in the 2016 academy was 75 hours. A reason for running training so long is an example of that would be this week where agents are deployed across the state in this emergency response to the hurricane. SBI and ALE agent trainee classes, there is a handout. That handout is published online. That handout is published online for you to view. It goes over the classes that are taught by the SBI Academy and the classes that are also taught in the ALE Agent Training Academy.
In addition to the handout that you can see online, which is just the baseline classes of the 720 hours that our agents receive, they also receive, on this slide, specialized training. The career path of an SBI agent can go into various locations and disciplines. So forth, they could be an arson agent, computer crimes, DECU agent, SRT, K-9, financial crimes, crime scene. And to do those disciplines, they are asked and mandated to take extra training on top of that. So just for an example, a crime scene agent, they'll go to a basic crime scene school, which is about 40 hours in addition to the academy, and then they must attend a 16-week National Forensic Academy just to stay current and qualify. Jason, you want to...
In the ALE Academy and some of our specialized training that we do majority of this is conducted in the academy. The career path that an ALE agent comes on with one core function in mind, and that is to do the job of an ALE agent. Some of the specialized training that they have to go through is alcohol-related death investigations and alcohol laws. That covers approximately 80 hours. We have the drug laws, gambling laws, rural and urban surveillance, that's roughly a one-week course for our guys. Technical surveillance training, nuisance abatement, we have a nuisance abatement team across the state. Those guys go through at least four semesters. They'll do that at a community college for their paralegal, to get their paralegal. They're in the process of doing that now. And then there's approximately 60 hours of training that is conducted for them, and that is done through several district attorneys around the state that have classes developed just for our nuisance abatement guys. We have a special operations group. Those individuals go through 40 hours of basic SWAT operator, and then they conduct monthly training also. We have tactical medics. They go through there, get their EMT certification, and then they have to go through monthly training. And we also have our K-9 handlers.
You want to talk about in-service?
In-service training, as Mr. Combs has already discussed earlier, we have in-service training throughout the year. That's both for the SBI and ALE. We conduct our in-service as it is handed down by training and standards. That's usually 24 mandated hours each year. Some of the courses that that covers is legal updates, juvenile minority sensitivity training, human trafficking. We do the firearms training. We also have 2016 North Carolina Firearms Laws, Citizens and Guns. We have department topics of choice that were chosen for this year, such as law enforcement intelligence update, leadership, modeling appropriate behaviors, recovery of mobile devices, and preservation of evidence. ALE also does additional training, just like the SBI does. Some of the ALE additional classes that we have is we did a use of force taser training, which was we incorporated some shoot, don't shoot into that. That was an 8-hour block of instruction. We did our quarterly firearms training, just like the SBI does the same, quarterly firearms training each year. ALE agents and some SBI agents also participated in the North Carolina State Highway Patrol shoot, don't shoot training. And I think there's some troopers in here, and we appreciate you guys offering that class to us and letting us attend that also. We did some handcuff training. And then there's some OSHA required classes that we also attend in order to keep our OSHA requirements up.
One of the additional things that the training section does as far as the SBI and ALE is we provide supervisory training to all of our supervisors. We have ASAC management schools or assistant special agent in charge schools to let them know how to become the best supervisor they can. We also send people to AOMP, which is the Administrative Officers Management Program, the Law Enforcement Executive Program, or LEAP, the Law Enforcement Executive Development Association, West Point Leadership Program, and the MDP Management Development Program. For our senior management, we send them also to the FBI National Academy, the Senior Management Institute for Police, or Police Executives Research Foundation, which is PERF, and the Southern Police Institute, which is in Louisville, Kentucky.
All right, gentlemen. Do y'all have any time to work?
A little.
No, I appreciate everything that you've done, and I encourage any of the members to call you, go out, ride with you, and see what you're doing.
And I think I speak for also SAC Wall that we would encourage any of you, if you would like to come to one of our academies while we're conducting an academy, if you would like to come down, sit through any of the classes, any of the courses, anybody from the General Assembly, we would welcome that. We do our 10-mile fun run at the end of the academy. You're welcome to come and do the 10-mile fun run with us also.
I'll be right behind Director Schumacher. Yes, we will. Any other questions?
Senator Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be glad to come, and I'd like appreciate the invitation. But till you mention the run part, that's not a necessity, I hope. But anyway, my question is: you have the ALE Advanced Training Academy, and does SBI not have an Advanced Training Academy or division of that?
Sir, what we call our Special Agent Academy is just by name. That theirs is the Advanced Agent Academy. We had chosen to call ours a Special Agent Academy, but essentially the same.
Okay. May I ask a couple more questions, Mr. Chairman?
Very shortly.
I'll do it.
Thank you.
First question, could a young man who finished the BLE training, et cetera, could he come directly to the SBI without experience in law enforcement? Would that be a possibility?
Yes, sir. We have both prior sworn people that are hired and non-sworn people that are hired, people with experience and without. Our qualifications do require them to have a four-year degree when they apply for us in hand, and either we can send them to BLET, or if they already have it, yes, they can apply and become an SBI agent.
Okay, and you say a four-year. Is that, would that be in criminal justice, or what would that be?
No, sir. There is no set discipline, but you must have a four-year Bachelor of Science or Administration degree.
Okay, I understand. And the last question I have would be, would the, I'd mentioned, asked this question earlier, could the public, you know, as long as they don't have some type of criminal background history, have an opportunity to sit in or take courses, or maybe not for credit, but, you know, say, for example, since today is such a, there's such a problem with computer hacking and that kind of thing and protection to the public, could they sit in, or would that be a no-no?
As it stands right now, it would be a no. Based on what we're teaching our agents to do and how they do their profession, it's somewhat, we try to keep it within ourselves.
Senator Bingham, is the 10-mile run scaring you from going to the academy, or?
Absolutely, just like it did you.
Well, yeah. Did I hear you trying to pick up one class? Senator Norman.
Of it, but anyway.
Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Bingham's looking for a new profession after he gets out of the General Assembly. I do have one question about your you mentioned the number of agents that are in your two for the SBI, two a year, for the ALE, one a year, 17 and 20. What is the graduation rate out of those academies?
At least for the SBI, I would say graduation rate is roughly 98%. We try to do as much as we can on the front end to make sure somebody's going to have that physical stamina and mental capability to get through that 19-week academy, but we do have some that don't quite make it.
Our graduation rate would probably be anywhere from 80 to 90%.
Thank you. Do y'all need a... Now, you are qualified to drive, aren't you? Any other questions? Thank you all for coming. Zach Wall and Zach Locklear and Director Schumacher, thank you. And thank you for what you're doing. And just be careful out there. All right. Coming on down, I think Senator Bingham qualifies for the Highway Patrol. This time we'd like to welcome Lieutenant Colonel West, and if you'll introduce your guest, please.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Bobby West, Director of Support Services for the Highway Patrol. Accompanying me today is Master Trooper Chris Day. Master Trooper Day oversees the driver training campus. He does the day-to-day activities and schedules instructors and plans courses for upcoming schools. I'd like to take a minute to thank you
Chairman Bowles, Chairman Randleman, and the committee for allowing us to talk about a subject that's we're very passionate about this. This is a main part of some of our training. What we do every day is drive, and we got to make sure our guys do it safe for not only ourselves, but the motoring public. What we're talking, also thank you for your continued support. Every day you support us, and we thank you. What we're here to talk about today would be the mission of the track, brief history, overview of the track, information on our instructors that teach at our track, and also students we train, courses we instruct, the course equipment used. I'd like to start by discussing the mission of the Highway Patrol Driver Training Facility. The mission of the North Carolina Highway Patrol Drivers Training Program is to provide vehicle operation training techniques to law enforcement officers, which will improve their driving skills, resulting in safe and efficient vehicle operation under both normal and emergency situations. Boils down to this, saving lives. We want to make sure our guys are safe, the public's safe, and we produce a good product that people can be proud of. A brief beginning, since the creation of the Highway Patrol by the General Assembly, an act effective 1st July 1929, the control continues to provide driver training for every class. Ever since the beginning, the inception of patrol, we have provided driver training. In the beginning, driving courses for the patrol were taught across the state at various locations to include small parking lots, airports. Many of these properties were owned by organizations and private citizens. In 1987, the General Assembly once again graciously appropriated funds for the construction of a driver training facility. This facility was destined to be built near the North Carolina Highway Patrol Training Center. The driving facility was constructed adjacent to Tryon Road near the academy on approximately 90 acres of land just off of Tryon Road. Here's an overview of our driver training facility. At the very top, you can see a large oval. That's our high-speed track. At the very bottom, you see a smaller semicircle. That's our alternate track. Over to the far right corner, you'll see buildings, and that's where our classrooms are and our observation tower. Our observation tower is what we use to control activities at the track. We keep a trooper in that at all times when people are on the track driving so we can coordinate and make sure no one runs afoul of another person out there. In the middle, you'll see a large square. That's our 600 by 600 driving pad. On that piece of asphalt, we conduct all of our precision driving courses. We do low-speed courses on the outer perimeter of that, and I'll explain low-speed courses a little bit later. As you move toward the center, you'll see four white triangles. Those triangles are what we call skid pads. We use those to teach steering and control of vehicles in wet conditions. You can't see it, but at the very bottom in the wooded area would be our four-wheel drive training, where we train people on how to operate four-wheel drives. Our track configurations are: the large oval is 1.1 miles. The large oval plus the alternate gives us a driving surface of just under 1.5 miles at 1.4. Our off-road course in the wooded area at the bottom is approximately 3/4 of a mile. Our skid pads are four, of course. You saw the four rectangles, 50 by 100 each. And our large cone course is 600 by 600 feet. And it's always cold, and it's always the wind blowing out there. Our driver training instructors, which are an integral part of any program as your instructors, no matter who it might be. Our driver training instructors are first of all overseen by patrol first sergeant, who's stationed at the academy. He oversees the whole operation. Next in line will be a patrol master trooper, Trooper Day. He oversees the day-to-day activities of the instructors, the scheduling, the courses, because at times we'll have organizations come to attract law enforcement organizations that have specialized needs in their driving, and we will tailor classes for their needs. The patrol uses its own members as driving instructors, and currently we have 85 troopers across the state who maintain their driving training certificates. This does not mean that every week we have training, we bring 85 troopers to the track, because we don't. What we do, we break it down into teams of 8 to 10 per team, and we'll rotate them through every week, and we pretty much maintain training, I believe, 50 to 52 weeks a year. Driver training instructors are required to complete a criminal justice instructor training course. In addition to that, they must also complete a 48-hour specialized driver instructor training course. The specialized course are regulated by the North Carolina Justice and Education and Training Standards Commission. The only two places in the state these schools are taught are the Justice Academy and Driver Training Facility. Into some of the courses we teach. We teach our basic schools. Our cadets are instructed. We have two types of schools. We have a short school, which are students who come to the patrol already basic law enforcement trained. Former police officers or have their training. The class that we teach them is a curriculum designed by the Highway Patrol because they already have their specialized, their driver training for law enforcement. They already have that behind them because they have the certification. It's a 40-hour course, which we include cone courses for position driving. We include high-speed, low-speed driving, as well as our precision immobilization training, our PIT training. The LON schools are for non-BLET certified cadets. These are cadets that come right out of college, right off the street, right off the farm, wherever we can get qualified, outstanding candidates. They come in. We teach them not only our block of instruction of 40 hours, but also the BLET part as they go through that part of the school. Of course, those are mandated courses by training standards, and we also teach the curriculum that we have. We teach other outside agencies in basic law enforcement training. We partner with Wake Technical Community College and Greensboro Police Academy. We have at times partnered and trained Raleigh Police Department and other agency, outside agencies. We provide ongoing in-service training for our members for continuing education every year to make sure that our troopers have sharp skills and do not become deficient. We also provide motorcycle certifications proficiency training. The patrol's motor unit, which is our motorcycle unit, teaches both basic motor school and motor unit in-service. Basic motor schools are often attended by both in-state and out-of-state agencies. These are not how to drive a motorcycle. When you get to our class, you are a law enforcement motorcycle operator, and we train intermediate and advanced courses, how to form escorts, how to recover motorcycles, those type classes. We also use the track for defensive tactics training. The defensive tactics units use our track to perform advanced vehicle stops for cadets that we have in our schools. These stops teach students the dangers of how to react to vehicle stops and how dangerous they can be. Cadets are presented with an array of scenarios which are performed in controlled environment, and they get live with these scenarios. They really tax the student because you never know what you're going to see on the roadway. They got to be prepared, and we got to prepare them for it. We do high-speed training on the large oval you saw in the alternate. This simulates high-speed chases or emergency responses where speeds can reach on our track of over 100 miles an hour. They are taught so we can teach proper lane control, setting up cars for curbs so they can properly maneuver cars through curbs and different roadway types, and also when and how to brake. We also teach low-speed training. This simulates chase. That'll be on our 600, the big square that you saw, the 600 by 600. That'll simulate chases inside the city limits, stop and go, intersections, that type setting. We also teach four-wheel drive training. This course instructs students how to navigate through rough or muddy terrain in four-wheel drive vehicles. Also, it teaches vehicle recovery and proper winching techniques, so if your car or your truck becomes disabled, you'll know how to maneuver out of it. Skid pad training, as we spoke before, will be performed on those four rectangles, which have been coated with special paint, which we can flood and irrigate with the irrigation system. Once they become wet, the student has to react in the skid. There'll be a student in the car. There'll be an instructor in the car. The instructor will probably be as scared as the student. They'll proceed through the skid pad. The instructor will induce a skid by use of a solenoid, a braking, make the car brake, and the student has to regain control of the car and exit the other side. We also teach executive protection training. This teaches the fundamentals of security and protection of dignitaries, how to avoid and how to react to threats. So we have people in the car we are protecting. We want to know what to do if terrorists jump out at it. If something happens, someone tries to block our vehicles in or harm the dignitaries, we need to know how to protect them and safely maneuver out of that situation to get everyone safe. We do the precision and mobilization. I'd say it real slow. I'm from Wayne County. It gets jumbled up. Training. This is the PIT course. This course teaches students how to perform controlled contacts between patrol vehicles and violator vehicles. What this does is the intention is to cause a suspect to spin out, which in turn will end the chase. I end the chase early if we have to. There's different reasons we end chases. We can call the chase off because of road conditions, hazards. It's too dangerous to chase. We can do the prima facie, get the license plate, or we can use this technique. But the reason to do this is to end it as quick as we can to prevent loss of life by anyone else. Who do we train? We train patrol basic school cadets, as mentioned earlier. We train them with BLET training, along with high-speed training and PIT courses. We train our patrol members. We teach them in-service and remedial. Continuing education is the in-service part with high-speed training, PIT training, etc., and also remedial training for when we identify a trooper who has a deficiency in their driving. We've got to keep their skill set, it's a perishable skill, at a high level. So that way, in turn, it protects lives and property. We also teach other instruct other law enforcement agencies, both in and out state, local departments come, and we tailor our courses. They'll contact Trooper Day, and he'll tailor a course to what their needs are, to specifically meet the needs, because what we teach might not address what they need. This helps them. We train other state law enforcement agencies. We've trained wildlife resource officers, SBI agents, ALE agents. These courses are tailored to fit their needs. An example of that would be like the wildlife resources. We formulated a backing course to teach them how to back wildlife trailers. We also train federal law enforcement agencies. We've done training with U.S. Marshals, the FBI, Secret Service, Joint Task Force units. All these departments have gone through a 40-hour block of instruction or have attended courses that have been modified to meet their needs at our training facility. How many people do we train? It sounds like a whole lot. And those courses we offer are not the only courses. We have numerous more courses, but those are the most often the ones we teach. Like I said, we can tailor-make a course to fit the needs of the agency. As you can see here, in a year, we could train just under 2,000 people at the track. That includes our basic school, in-service, local department, motorcycle, and specialized training. Next, what you'll find here is a picture of an example of our four-wheel drive training course. As you can see at the very top of the slide, there's a pickup truck coming, a truck that we use for training, and he'll have to traverse that muddy hole and those ruts, and then later if he gets stuck, he'll have to winch his truck out. We'll teach him how to recover their vehicle. Also in our four-wheel drive training course, we teach simulated aircraft crashes, and we set those scenes up, and we teach students to use their four-wheel drive vehicles to reach the site and conduct recovery and rescue missions. This is just one of many scenarios that we can create out in the wooded area. Here's a skid pad. This is what I was discussing. You see the white surface. That's a special paint that's been put on the surface. And you see the irrigation in the car. Crosses it. Solenoids hit. Panic sets out in the car. Student hopefully makes it to the other side. And the instructor continues to instruct. Paramount thing that we think of that track is safety. Safety for the instructor. Safety for the student. That's an ongoing mission. With speeds reaching 100 miles an hour, you can only imagine the catastrophic ending if we weren't prepared for it. In our high-speed cars, we outfit the cars with a 5-point safety harness, window netting, halon fire suppression systems that can be hit just like in the NASCAR, a NASCAR roll cage. They're retrofitted with steel wheels because years ago we found, I'm a driving instructor, not as much as I used to, thank goodness, but those wheels were given away. Those wheels were breaking the factory wheels. So we had to go back. They designed steel wheels, and that's what we put on the cars to ensure they'll hold up under the stress and strain. The fuel tanks have been removed in the back of the car and placed with fuel bladders. So in the event of a crash or a rupture, we won't lose fuel, and it'll reduce the chance of ignition. We also use, and the cars are equipped with a VHF radio for intra-car communication and also communication with the tower. And also during chase scenarios, those VHF radios are used to talk between the cars, so you can simulate having a primary car or a secondary car. And it gives the students a real chance to talk on the radio and have to realize all the stressors that go on during a chase. Here's an example of the inside of one of our high-speed cars. As you can see, the roll cage, the netting. You can see the radios. It's kind of dark on the inside. I apologize for that, but this is a typical setup. Here's our four-wheel drive training vehicles. These vehicles are ones we obtained through surplus and other departments have wheeled over to us. This is our precision and mobilization training vehicles. As you can see, the rear bumpers have been removed and replaced with reinforced steel. This is to prolong the life of the car so we're not tearing up cars at driving track, which would lead to an early demise of our facility. We started tearing up cars. In conclusion, the Bachola Driving Facility, as you can see, is used for much more than one might initially believe. It serves as an outstanding training facility and has proven to be a very valuable asset in training students, and ultimately what we're our goal is to save lives. Thank you.
Thank you. Lieutenant Colonel, do you need a driving instructor? I have one that's going to be available in January.
Mr. Chair, we can make that happen.
Senator Bingham, you have a question?
Yeah, I was. I noticed all the training that you gave, and you gave quite a bit of training to the federal folks. You know, I assume they would have, rather extensive training capabilities themselves. So I was kind of curious as to how that came to be.
Well, we do a lot of back and forth.
Step up to the mic and state your name, please.
It's Trooper Day, Chris Day with the Highway Patrol. I'm assigned to the driving track. We do a lot of training, trading off. So we'll go to them, they come to us, and we just got a good relationship. And we, you know, we trade stuff all the time, learning how they do stuff. We'll take it back and incorporate it in our stuff. So it kind of helps us out.
Same tax dollars. Yep. Any others? Okay. Thank you, sir. Thank you. Thank you all for what you're doing, and thank you. At this time, we have adult corrections and juvenile justice training. Deputy Commissioner Joe Prater. And I would just like to say this is a department that never gets recognition. You do quite a Omen's job for what budget you have, and I know you're all, especially your correctional officers, starting pay is well below what needs to be, and we need to work on that. I thank you all for what you do. Nobody knows a correctional officer, and there are unsung heroes that keep justice intact. I would like to ask the condition of the three officers from Langford. Is that the name? Lanesboro. I understand that was an unfortunate situation there, what I read in the newspaper. And I think about them often.
Thank you. We'll get
that too. And Representative McNeil, do you have a. Okay, I'm sorry. And roughly, this is the department that has the largest employees and DPS and largest facilities and a very critical part of the public safety. Deputy Commissioner?
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen, appreciate the opportunity to be here. My name is Joe Prater. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, Division of Adult Correction and Juvenile Justice. First, Representative Bowles, let me say how much we appreciate the support that you and your colleagues have provided in recognizing correctional officers along with the governor's office. We feel that is something that's going to be very beneficial to us, not only now, but moving forward, as I'll talk about in our presentation. So, again, thank you so much for your support of that. It's nice to be before you again this afternoon. Appreciate the opportunity to share with you information about our staff development and training operations. I will tell you this, that my presentation is admittedly less about operational details. It's less about statistical metrics and data, And it is more about a recognition on our part to come to you at this point, out of the gates, before the coming session, to share with you our thoughts as adult correction and juvenile justice faces a crossroads that we've not faced before in how we do business. And more importantly, how that affects our staff development and training. That's what I would like to achieve this afternoon in talking to you about that. I will tell you that we do have plenty who can provide you with that information, and certainly we are happy to provide you with the details, operational details, statistical information, those kinds of things upon your request. Before beginning, I would like to introduce some in the audience. First, I'd like to introduce Mr. Charles Walston, who is the director of the Office of Staff Development and Training. Mr. Walston does an excellent job in running that operation. Mr. Walston is also a current standing member of the Standards Commission. Beside him is Monica Chabot. She is the deputy director of the Office of Staff Development and Training. And again, we appreciate the great work they do in providing that. My presence before you this afternoon is an indication of the Commissioner's Office's full commitment and recognition of the importance and the relevance of our moving forward staff development and training as we move into this new period of our history. And we do like the opportunity to talk about our operations, and we can't talk about our operations without talking about that staff development and training as well. So what I'd like to do in the presentation today is talk a little bit about these things. Let me first put all of this in context by saying these things. First, while we do talk a lot about quote-unquote training, and we have a lot of details about training, what I want to emphasize at this point is our operations are greatly focused, probably more than ever before, on staff development. The professional development of our staff from the front line to our managers is so important for us going forward. Secondly, my objective today is to reveal to you the absolute scope and scale of the work that our Office of Staff Development and Training is made up of. Our operations are large, and I'll give you that indication. And finally, as I've alluded to previously, I have to emphasize to you that in an unprecedented way, in an absolute unprecedented way, our staff development and training operations are now challenged with being a leader in taking us to what we call our new day. Call it criminal justice reform, call it transformation, call it a new day, but whatever you call it, it is something that our staff has got to buy into. We have to develop the standards to move in that direction and to meet those new day demands. Let me talk to you just a little bit for those who may not be familiar with adult correction and juvenile justice. It's made up of prisons, community corrections, and juvenile justice, both certified and non-certified staff, totaling about 21,000 employees. And to go with those, there are also subsidiary operations that we have that are also required to have training. Our staff manages this through a main office in Apex, and we have 5 regional offices statewide. So I'd like to go through that, who we are, what we do, challenges and initiatives, and where we're going, and we'd be glad to answer questions after that. A little bit of information here. Division of Adult Correction and Juvenile Justice Office of Staff Development and Training is essentially a statewide school system. I have to tell you that with the tragic events of this week, the weather issues and the Hurricane Matthew effects, devastating effects on our state, it became obvious to me that we are very much, we, Office of Staff Development and Training, which I have direct oversight of and very proud of, had to make a lot of calls, had to make a lot of contacts. We have a lot of officers across this state who were affected by that, in that they were unable to get to their training, or that were unable to get trainers there, or were unable to have facilities available. And while I always try to keep in perspective, you know, operations to those who are really suffering out there, we do recognize that it's an impact on our operation. So when I started thinking about that, I thought about this in terms of a very large, if you will, school system that runs what I call left to right across our state. And you may find it interesting to know that school system trains about 30,345 students a year. That's from 2015, and I'm not suggesting to you that's individual students one across. That means we may have one student that would be through several times. That means we've touched a student in seatback training over 30,000 times a year. And these are students coming from 181 various work locations, taught at 104 different training sites, and we utilize about 90 full-time staff to do that. Another thing I'm very, very proud of is the fact that we are considered a national leader in the use of the state's learning management system that's been up and running for a little while. We have our IT folks who are called upon within Office of Staff Development and Training to assist not only state folks, but national people as well, and I'm very proud of that. So with that size of training operation, we try to find every nook and cranny we can find where we can do training. And we establish partnerships wherever we can to achieve that training. So what we do in a nutshell is that we have these basic categories of basic training, in-service training, career development training, and physical abilities testings, and I want to mention something about wellness programs as well. And you can see the numbers there, the 4 weeks correctional officer basic training, the 5 weeks for PPOs, and 4 weeks for juvenile justice staff. And you can see the numbers. Those are the number of students that went through those in 2015. Just a wide range of in-service training. I've just listed a few of those things, ranging from firearms qualification through professional ethics. We cover all of those. We have an extensive list of those items. But also career development. We have mid-level managers. We have these other things, the correctional leadership development training. I attend those from time to time, and I will tell you they refresh me when I see young leaders that we've identified who are going to carry us into the future. Those kinds of training events are really very, very enlightening to go to, and they're uplifting as well. And we have other first-line supervisor training and other management peak performance, it's called. There's a lot of these things we need to be doing and are doing for career development. We've employed and started using physical abilities testing, so-called COPAT, which we have, and that is implemented by Office of Staff Development and Training. We're beginning to stand that up and moving that forward. We're finding that we're having benefits with that and doing physical abilities testing, particularly for correctional officers, as we're seeing that showing its benefits to us in many ways, in that we can attain officers who are physically able to do the work that we need them to do. Wellness programs, I want to emphasize that, because not only is that about wellness, but we know that our profession is unfortunately very plagued with high suicide rates. And it compares nationally with many of those, like in military and other types of professions. And we saw early on that we needed to develop some things that would help our staff recognize potential suicide among their fellow staff members. We also believe that overall wellness and balance of life is important to all of our officers in the field and all of our administrative staff. So the Office of Staff Development and Training are responsible for providing that as well. Very important to us. We know that we have to have partnerships. We have outside resources and in-house for the partnership. First, Department of Public Safety, we use facilities and staffing. For example, we'll use prisons. We use community corrections facilities. We're very fortunate to have a partnership with the North Carolina National Guard, Fort Fisher, those types of facilities within the Department of Public Safety. And we utilize all of them wherever we can. Staffing. We utilize adjunct instructors within prisons and within community corrections. We have general instructors that we train to help us with our ongoing training demands. More recently, we've actually partnered with healthcare providers within our operations, as we've got to change the new day, and we know that involves a lot of health services, and so we're training a lot more in partnerships with our healthcare folks as well. We appreciate the support the Department of Justice provides to us at Salemburg and Edneyville. We're very appreciative of that. Community colleges, we have a wonderful standing relationship with them, and we appreciate that. I was talking to Dr. Chapman a little earlier and was thanking her for that. We just are very appreciative that they step up and help us in so many things. I have also want to mention to you the North Carolina Forest Service has helped us. They've come forward and made some of their facilities available to us as well, and we appreciate that. Universities. I want to mention this just for a moment to tell you that we have agreements with various universities to provide affordable education advancement for our employees. What this means is we've entered agreements with universities who are interested in helping our correctional officers get more education to improve their professionalism, to improve their lot in life, maybe even consider being promoted to a probation officer and move on up in other worlds in corrections. And with Director Walston's initiative, we've reached out to these universities. We offer these courses both in seat and online for our officers, and we make them available to them in an affordable way where we can take advantage of that. Community colleges have come forward to where they're telling us they will give us certain credits for basic training toward hours for our employees to go get an associate's degree at community colleges. That's a fantastic partnership. We appreciate the support law enforcement provides to us, police departments, sheriff's offices, firing ranges, other facilities. Two more I want to mention. The United States Marine Corps and the U.S. Army. That is something I'm extremely proud of, and I will direct my attention to Director Walston again and to J.R. Gorham, who have worked diligently on this. And that is, we believe there's a tremendous source there for the military separating to come into corrections. And along with the governor's initiatives and this state initiative to hire those military personnel when they're coming out, I'm very pleased to say we have agreements with these military agencies. We actually have a certified training facility on base with Camp Lejeune where those who are interested separating from the military to become a correctional officer can be hired there, can be trained on site. Military has given us the authority to train them before they actually come out. They know where they're going to go. They know the job they're going to have, and they come to us fully trained. They are fully trained. They've been through the whole training. That's a great relationship. We understand. I'm told that Camp Lejeune currently has 800 per month coming through there, separating from the military. What a great resource. Likewise, we've gotten with the U.S. Army. We have an off-site location that we've worked with the U.S. Army, but it is a commitment where we've said to them, we think you've got a great labor pool for us. You've got those who are physically ready, those who are ready to go, need a job. We want them to stay in North Carolina, and we're going to train them right there with you as they separate and come to us. Very proud of that. The other thing that's not on there, I want to mention our Bertie Cadet Program. We have reached out to Bertie County, worked with the governor's office, Bertie County, county manager, county commissioners, and the community college in that area, where we have 16 high school students who we believe have an interest in criminal justice, and we are working with those high school students and trying to get them to stay in school, get educated, and you know what? If you're interested in corrections, we got something for you. We find dedicated young individuals who may be interested in coming to us. We think that's a great, great program. Finally, let me talk about these challenges and initiatives that we have. The first two items are interrelated: timeliness of basic training and training backlog reduction. We know we need to train correctional officers more quickly, more timely, before they are in those facilities. We know facilities demand that. We have a time of 4 to 5 months that it takes to get them in there. We want to get them trained more quickly. We also want to reduce the training backlog. Right now, we have a backlog of about 637 that we have not been able to train at this point. But they're interrelated in this sense. The timeliness of the basic training and the backlog reduction has an awful lot to do with the vacancies that exist at those facilities where we're trying to train those folks. If they have vacancies, it's difficult for us to get that wheel turning. So what I want you to know and what I emphasize to you is that we believe that what we've got to do is we can fix that by doing better hiring process, better retention process, and try to stabilize that vacancy rate to where we can catch up and maybe even consider more timely training and getting them on the floor, getting them into job at the facility in a more timely manner. So we're working on that. We want to make sure we're able to do that well. That is one of our first priorities. Secondly, predictability and efficiencies of having dedicated training facilities and firing ranges available for our use. Because we're large, because we're spread out, because we look for every nook and cranny we can, adding some predictability and stability to where we could schedule those is to our advantage as an organization. I want to thank the Governor's Office. I want to thank the General Assembly for your approval of Samarkand Training Academy. Representative Bowles, I remember when we were there September 2015 talking to the first graduating class at Samarkand from basic correctional officer. That was a great moment, and that is a fantastic facility, and we appreciate your support. Since its completion and startup, we've had 226 Division of Adult Correction and Juvenile Justice students gone through class at Samarkand Training Academy. Next item, timeliness in curriculum changes to meet changing demands. That means we need to be nimble to change to meet the new day. When I see Commissioner Geis presenting nationally and statewide about prisons becoming mental health de facto institutions, when I hear of the additional challenges and things we have to face with a different and new kind of juvenile justice population, when we know we have certain responsibilities and obligations we need to meet on this new day to do better in our business, we've got to be able to nimbly change our curriculum to meet those needs. So we want to have some discussion about how we can move with the day in a very timely way. We need enhanced workforce preparedness and professionalism. We need to educate our folks for the new day. And finally, speaking of the new day, here they are, where the demands of that really relate to a lot of things, but in particular, it relates to the implementation of justice reinvestment and remissioning. We do feel that we're a national leader in these things. In order to maintain that position and do these correctly, we've got to train to those things. So what this means is, and you know this because we've talked to you about it, and we'll talk to you some more in the coming session, it is now a balance of control and behavior modification. That is a change of culture. That's a change in operations. Things like mental health, substance use disorders, chronic illnesses, aging inmate population, combined with the reality that there's a more volatile population within our prisons. So things like enhanced communication skills, we have got to teach our folks how to de-escalate situations while maintaining proper control. Crisis intervention training. This is the type of thing that both law enforcement and adult correction and juvenile justice are starting to see. This is where you need to work with folks, have these soft skills, have these things that actually can de-escalate situations. But more than that, teaches our folks how to recognize the difference between this scenario and that scenario in dealing with a crisis. We have mental health first aid. This is so important to us now. We have community corrections folks and our juvenile justice folks who are trained at that. And in order to go forward, we've got to have succession. We have to have folks have buy-in to our new day, and that means more supervisory leadership skills enhancement. We need to teach folks how to work with folks, how to communicate, and to move forward. And finally, expansion of technology. Just like the rest of the world, we got a ways to go with technology. We can really go places with technology. In fact, I find that our world is very ripe for that. We talk about things like tablets. We talk about laptops, both in the offender world as well as our staff world. So we need more of that. We need to use more of the learning management system. We basically want to go to our training being more paperless than it is now. So specifically relating to training, we feel that we need to get caught up, and we will, in a more paperless approach to that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Bryant.
I know at one point we were talking about some enhanced support around mental health within the prison system. Yes, ma'am. And I see you have mental health first aid there. Mm-hmm. Is that something that everybody does? And are there any other interventions you are doing in terms of educating the staff to note to monitor and be aware of how to handle people who are confined who have mental illness?
The mental health first aid is kind of a targeted type thing that we are doing now. We have other things. The other training that we've got to do is we've talked to you some in the budget about something called a therapeutic diversion unit, where we're actually working with those that would come out as a step down in a therapeutic way. There's an intensive training around that as well. So when you've got correctional officers that are working in an environment that has a therapeutic diversion unit, they're going to get specialized training for that in addition to what I'm talking about here. I think we're going to discover even more types of training we're going to have to do in the mental health area. That is definitely a very fluid area that we're very, very, very focused on right now.
Follow up.
I also am aware that a significant demographic in the prison system are people of color, disproportionately so, and maybe even your staff is in the same relative proportion. I'm thinking in Eastern North Carolina, it's also significantly people of color. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking, do you do any work in the prison system around addressing issues of race and diversity and cultural differences in the as it relates to the population you have and the workers you have?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Very good question. Also, there's a gender. We find we have a lot of females who are working in our prison environment. Diversity training is very important to us. When we talk about the leadership skills, enhancement, those types of things, that is probably the first thing we're talking about is recognition of diversity. Yes, ma'am. We do have curriculum that are set up. We need to do more of that, too, as we move forward.
One other thing.
Yes, go ahead.
I was also wondering, do you directly address sexual orientation issues and gender identity issues? I know they do come up in the prison system, that is LGBTQ issues that may come up as it relates to the confined population,
right,
as well as staff members.
I'm not really sure that I'm able to answer that because I'm not sure I have all the information. We'd be glad to get you some more information about that.
I think
ma'am.
That would
we
be
recognize that as an issue.
Just follow
one
up.
Final comment. I know in the PREA work, mm-hmm. that's the rape elimination. What does that stand for?
Yeah, that's the Prison Rape Elimination Act.
Okay, and I don't know what kind of training it requires, but in some respects, the two would be related, but it not they don't have to necessarily be related,
right.
But that would be a more of a crisis reason to have that kind of training. But I think in general, in terms of having a safer environment as well as a more culturally, more of an understanding, an environment where staff understands what to expect mm-hmm. and how to manage the confinement population around these issues.
Yes, ma'am.
I think would surely be helpful.
It would. Yes, ma'am. Sensitivity to that we have to address. Yes, ma'am.
Other questions from the committee? Seeing none, Mr. Prater, thank you for coming today. Thank you, very informative. Oh, excuse me, Mr. Prater. Senator Bingham.
I almost made it.
It won't be tough. Okay. But anyway, thank you. thank you, Madam Chairman. you mentioned the high suicide rate, and that concerned me. And I guess in being a national leader in the learning management systems, and this issue of the suicide rates, is that being addressed in this management systems? And secondly, what would you attribute that to, or is that something that y'all have identified? And I guess you've probably got high turnover rates because of this, for this reason. I mean, it would seem to go hand in hand.
Mr. Prater.
Yes, thank you, Senator Bingham. First, with the information about the suicide rate, I'm not sure that I can give you the details, but we have studies that we've seen, and there are attributes that are identified in those studies that tend to lead toward higher suicide rates. Obviously, the work environment, obviously the stress that goes with it, obviously those kinds of things that, just as a practical sense, we can all generally understand. If we were working in a confined facility for a period of time, I mean, that's understood. We have a program that we do through LMS and we do through other training that, if we have a moment, I would very much like Director Walston to be able to address, if you have just a moment. It is very important to us, if Director Walston could.
If you will come to the mic and introduce yourself, please.
Charles Walston, the Director of the Office of Staff Development and Training. We have several programs that we've been delivering to staff. One is called From Corrections Fatigue to Fulfillment. It was based on a federal grant through the National Institute of Correction. It is an 8-hour end-user program that's really intended to help allow staff to discuss in a non-threatening environment some of the volatilities that they experience in a criminal justice career field, working around traumatic situations that might involve staff assaults or offender-on-offender assaults. It can be very alarming and very difficult to get those images out of your mind sometimes. So the Corrections Fatigue to Fulfillment, again, it is a 8-hour end-user program that's designed to help staff talk about and discuss with their peers some of the issues that really cause stress, and then look at the positive benefits associated with the offender change process. Another program that we're using is the QPR program, Question, Persuade, Refer, and it is a 2-hour gatekeeper suicide program. It's intended to help people reach out to someone that may be dealing with a mental health crisis and just ask in a non-threatening way, are you thinking about harming yourself? Is there something that we can talk about? And through engaging people, the hope is that we can prevent some of those self-destructive behaviors that we have seen in certain cases.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Bingham, did you have a follow-up?
I'll not tie the committee up. I may talk to you individually if I could.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Yes, Senator Sanderson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Director Prater, on your Bertie County cadet program, can you tell me how long that's been going on and anything about the success that it is?
Yes, sir. Senator, the program has gone on. At my recollection, it's been about 6 months or so, a year. I have to tell you, we've got a staff person who is so excited about that. I would love for her to be able to share that with you. I want to give that the credit it can, but it is 15 students. It took a lot of legwork on our staff's part to go out and talk to the students. The governor's office was particularly interested in doing something there. Where they are in their classes and where that is, I would have to defer to one of our staff folks to let you know that, and be glad to do that. She's here today if you'd like to hear more about that.
Madam Chair, I would, but I mean, I can do it offline.
Have the information provided to the committee.
We'd be happy to. Be glad to. Thank you, sir.
Senator Bryant.
I had a follow-up question that I was on my list, but it didn't occur to me until you were answering Senator Bingham's question about the suicide, and it's similar to a question I asked earlier in that, are there ways you address emotional literacy or how to deal with feelings? We know that there are many studies about the emotional challenges of dealing, being the managers in a confinement facility, whether you are doing the right thing or not, there have to be some feelings that will come up for you as you have to toughen up to manage that. Do you all address that in any way directly?
Yes, ma'am, we do. That is so key. We've got to be able to address those emotional feelings. And, you know, I would have to hazard a guess that in years past that's not been a forte that has occurred. And that is all part of that stream of if we're going to be officers in an environment respecting each other and respecting the offenders and recognizing those situations, we can improve that environment for everyone. And so, yes, that's very much part of our training now.
And just to know that in having to enforce some of the rules you have to enforce, there's going to be some painful feelings.
Oh, absolutely.
And the workers have to have a way to discharge or talk about those kind of painful feelings that, to me, would inevitably come up.
Yes, ma'am.
With that kind of job. And then one more follow-up. I just want to go on record, and I've expressed this concern in our committee before, about some of the working conditions that I've heard from both family members and just the constituents. And some of it's a part of just, I guess, how you have to run the business. But you've already mentioned that you have high turnover, I think, and sometimes inadequate staffing. But you have those 12-hour shifts, as I remember. People don't have clearly defined, like, lunch breaks and other breaks, depending on what staffing is available, where there are injuries. Sometimes you don't have light work to accomplish. You know, it's stressful for people if they do get injured, which often will happen. Then getting back to work can be a difficult pattern if you can't provide light work for people, so they aren't so stressed about that. So I think if there are, I just want to go on record as saying if there's some things we could look at around simple working conditions, a break, a non-duty lunch hour that's defined, that kind of thing, and the staffing that would help manage that, that could go a long way toward helping mental health be in the workers.
Yes, ma'am. Senator, thank you for that. We're very, very focused on the fact that we know that we've got to improve there to move forward with the new day. And as Director Walston was talking about, this fatigue to fulfillment is one thing. Getting us fully staffed to where we can have some flexibility is another thing. And so that they all tie together. And we accept that challenge, and we'd like to get there.
Just one final thing.
One final, important. Yes.
And also, I've heard from people, it just occurred to me, even some retirees, that people, because of the staffing, they can't take the time off that they have on the books. And then in some circumstances, you lose it. You know, if it's that extra time we've given over the years, you know, in lieu of raises, when you retire, you even lose it. So when people can't take off, you got those other challenges. You know, that adds to mental health stress, too. So.
Absolutely. Yes, ma'am. And we hope to fix that, too. We've got to get those vacancies down. We've got to improve in retention. We've got to improve in how we're hiring. We lower those vacancies. We can fix that, I believe.
Seeing no other questions, Mr. Prater, thank you. Our next meeting date is November the 10th. And if there's nothing further from any member, and staff says that they're going to send out some dates for different site visits. So if you want to participate in a site visit, you can make your selection, and we hope all of you will participate. But thank you, and this meeting is adjourned.